The show is live and local. It's your local performance connection. I'm Kevin Kelly, and on the program today, later on, we'll be talking with music director of the Heartland Festival Orchestra, David Commande, about their next concert, which actually has, performance and a half this weekend. We'll let David explain that later, but their main concert is on Saturday at Five Points Washington, and then most of that concert repeated on Sunday. And that's the second half of our program. But first, we'll be talking with the actors and director of the opening concert of the 40th season by the Celebration Company at the Station Theater in Urbana. The play is called God of Carnage by Yasmina Reza. And we'll be hearing some scenes from that play live in our studio. It's live and local. My guests on this portion of Live and Local are a number of folks involved in the current production at the Station Theater in Urbana, put on by the Celebration Company. In fact, the whole cast is here, to be perfectly honest, which is not saying a whole lot because it's such a small cast. And it's a play called God of Carnage by Yasmina Reza, directed by Rick Orr, who's the artistic director of the Celebration Company. And Rick, before we actually even talk about this play, not only is this the new season, but it's the 40th season.
Yes, indeed it is, yes.
Which is something.
It's something to celebrate, indeed, yes.
Hence the Celebration Company, although that came before you had 40 years to celebrate. And you have been in it since the beginning.
As a founder,
since
yes.
The beginning.
Yes.
Yeah. What gave you the harebrained idea to start a theater company?
Well, as an undergrad at the University of Illinois in the theater department, at that particular time, particularly in New York City, there was a movement called experimental theater and happenings and rather new playwrights, authors. And I and four or five other people thought, wow, you know, it'd really be cool to do some of these newer works that, you know, the Midwest has not even seen. And this was before even the Chicago theater scene took off. And so we began one summer, and my gosh, it has continued thanks to the energy and the talent and all these years and the community's support.
What was your first play?
First play was, I think, in the season, well, the summer was Jacques Brel's Alive and Well, Living in Paris. And the very first season then, I think, was The Fantastics. And that was in 72.
And was The Fantastics cutting edge at that point?
No, it was traditional obviously, and it still remains a traditional piece of musical theater. And I think at the time we simply had a small pool of talent. And as I remember at the time, who's the sports writer? His daughter was in it.
Where
Melissa Tate. She was quite a singer then. And so, you know, she was the title role of the girl. And we had the talent available, and so that was the first show.
And Jacques Brel was, I mean, that was a little more on the cutting edge of things.
It was. It was very new then, very new.
What has... Can you make any generalizations about the sort of play that has been typical of the station through that time, or has it changed?
No, probably we've remained true to the kind of the concept of our doing live theater, and that's the newer, edgier works. Again, the more modern works that challenge ourselves and our audience members.
And new often means in a given year you might be doing something that was written in the last few years.
That's right. But of course we have to wait until equity companies in our area finish doing the production, and because we're an amateur nonprofit group. So again, this is a very, very new work for amateur work playwrights to do.
So the term amateur is in this case literally true in the sense that everybody works for all the actors work for free.
Yes, we're all volunteers.
But it's not necessarily true in the sense that you got a lot of veteran actors.
Of course, yes.
And then are not really amateur. And you also have a lot of people who do professional theater, or some people who do professional theater outside of here, or sometimes in our area.
Sure. Sometimes some of the actors have traveled to Chicago to do productions.
What's your own background that's got you and made you want to do this and get involved in it in the first place?
Well, my background is a theater major, first class, I think, to graduate from Cranert. I transferred from Lincoln Hall. Undergrad, master's in theater, also in directing. I went on to work on a PhD in speech communications here, another master's in leisure study kinesiology, a TA for many years. And, I think our Kay Holly is with me here today, an older company member.
Careful what term you use.
I know. I said older company member. I think at our count, we've done about 430 shows.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow. So it sounds like maybe the better question for me to ask you as far as qualifications go, which what's your qualifications to do flowers? Because many people know you.
Talk to garden clubs and design panels and so forth. For me, the transference is very easy. You've got an empty vase and you fill it with line, motion, color, texture. As a director, you have an empty space, a stage, and you fill it with people of different heights and costuming, and the sets and the lights come in, and it makes a stage picture. And presumably at any time during the show, if you stop it and take a picture, it's perfectly balanced and has color, rhythm, line, the same as a vase or arrangement of flowers.
Sounds like you've thought about that for a while.
Well, I've been asked many times, and how the transference, and for me it works very easy. You fill an empty space, and be it a major party, a wedding, an intimate setting in a home, it still has to do with line, texture, color, movement. The same thing is true with theater and directing.
The play we're going to talk about now, which is the one that is opening on the 6th, just in just a few days, is another one of those plays that's been written in the last number of years, about 5 years ago?
Well, it won the Tony Awards in 2009. I think best play, best director, best actor. I think Chicago has done the show, but it's rather new for amateur theater groups to be doing this play.
And was this your choice, this play?
It was, yes.
Why God of Carnage?
Oh, it's... Well, first of all of our directors really submit projects or plays that are very close to them, have a meaning to them personally. We never really assign directors to a given show. A director that submits a project really has to feel the need to do it and have be inspired to do a particular production. This, as well as the last play of the season, I have a strong identity with as a director, and the outcome of it for production means with our local actors.
You know, identity in what sense?
In reading it, having a feeling for the characters, the moment, the story, the staging. Often if I have a very positive feeling about a play, I also tend to read it in color. The colors appear. In terms of costuming and set and so forth. And so for me, that's a very good sign that, you know, I'm identifying with this as a possible director.
Does that suggest that you do your own costume and stage design?
No. It's a collaboration. We have Deb Richardson is the costume designer for the show, and Rachel Witt has designed the set. It's a collaboration. We talk about colors. We talk about where in the theater we're going to define the space. And but no, for me, it's just a close identity very early on of having a strong feeling about the project.
The title, God of Carnage, suggests awful things that could happen on stage. Well, and I read the description, but it's not clear to me, is this a serious play or a comic play?
It's often described as a savage comedy. It's
savage comedy.
A savage comedy. And I also, in doing research of the play, discovered that the playwright, who's French, based this on a true incident that she heard about from a friend on a playground, of two boys getting in a fight on the playground. And from that, two couples meet to try to come to terms with how to deal with the situation of the fight that occurred on the playground. And it certainly turns into various alliances happening throughout the play, and in the end turns into something rather unexpected as to the reason of their first being here together as a couple. But again, it's described as a savage comedy. I think it's very funny.
Well, how many alliances can you have with just four people?
Well, there's alliances of the two women, alliances of the two men, sometimes the couples, and they change, and it's a rather roller coaster ride of alliances and emotions.
Sometimes it turns on a dime from one to another.
It sounds like a rather typical play for the Station Theater. I got an unusual story, or at least maybe a story that sounds usual enough and then becomes not so. And then it's got an ensemble cast where you can really exploit, so to speak, the talents of not very many people, and they can play off of each other a lot. And so let's introduce the four members of the cast. The play is called God of Carnage. It's going to open on the 6th at the Station Theater in Urbana. Rick Orr is directing, and Jessa Thomas is in the role of Veronica. Dave Barkley as Michael.
That's bad.
I'm actually playing Annette.
You're playing Annette.
Mm-hmm.
I'm reading off of your website. Somebody needs to fix this here.
Oh, yeah. There was a change.
Okay, so Jessa Thomas is... So this is what you mean by changing alliances here. They even change characters even before they get on the stage. So Jessa Thomas is in the role of Annette. That means Rachel Bradley is in the role of Veronica. Mm-hmm. David Barkley, are you actually playing Michael?
I'm playing Michael, yes.
Okay, which means Jeremiah Lowry is in the role of Alan.
Correct.
Of course, at this point, if you don't know the play, as I do not, these are just names anyway. So, assuming that David would not be playing Veronica, although at the Station Theater anything could happen. Why don't we launch into one of the scenes you brought along?
Sure. I think the first scene we're going to do is the opening of the play.
So no further introduction needed then.
Takes place in a living room in an apartment in Brooklyn.
So this is our statement. You'll be doing your own, of course. At 5:30 p.m. on the 3rd of November, in Cobble Hill Park, following a verbal altercation, Benjamin Raleigh, 11, armed with a stick, struck our son Henry Novak in the face. This action resulted in, apart from a swelling of the upper lip, the breaking of two incisors, including injury to the nerve in the right incisor.
Armed.
Armed? You don't like armed? What should we say, Michael? Furnished? Equipped. Furnished. With a stick. Is that all right?
Furnished, yes.
Furnished with a stick.
Furnished. The irony is we've always regarded Cobble Hill Park as a haven of security, unlike Whitman Park.
She's right. We've always said Cobble Hill Park, yes. Whitman Park, no.
Absolutely. Anyway, thank you for coming. There's nothing to be gained from getting stuck down some emotional cul-de-sac.
We should be thanking you. We should.
I don't see that any thanks are necessary. Fortunately, there is still such a thing as the art of coexistence, isn't there?
Which the children don't appear to have mastered. At least, not ours.
Yes, not ours. What's going to happen to the tooth with the affected nerve?
We don't know yet. They're being cautious about the prognosis. Apparently, the nerve hasn't been totally exposed.
Only a little bit of it's been exposed.
Yes. Some of it's been exposed, and some of it's still covered. That's why they've decided not to kill the nerve just yet.
They're trying to give the tooth a chance.
Obviously, it would be best to avoid endodontic surgery.
Well, yes.
So there'll be an interim period while they give the nerve a chance to recover.
In the meantime, they'll be giving him ceramic crowns.
Whatever happens, you can't have an implant before you're 18.
No.
Permanent implants can't be fitted until you finish growing.
Of course. I hope it all works out.
Yes, I hope so.
Those tulips are gorgeous.
They're from that little Korean deli up on Smith Street. You know the one at the end?
Oh, yes.
They come every morning direct from Holland. $40 for a bunch of 50.
Oh, really?
You know the one at the end?
Yes, yes.
You know, he didn't want to identify Benjamin.
No, he didn't.
Impressive sight, that child. Face bashed in, teeth missing, still refusing to talk.
I can imagine.
He also didn't want to identify him for fear of looking like a tattletale in front of his friends. We have to be honest, Veronica. It was nothing more than bravado.
Of course, but bravado is a type of courage, isn't it?
That's right. So how... What I mean is, how did you manage to get Benjamin's name?
Well, we explained to Henry he wasn't helping this child by shielding him.
We said to him, if this child thinks he can keep on hitting people with impunity, why should he stop?
We said to him, if we were this kid's parents, we would definitely want to be told.
Absolutely.
Thus ends the beginning of God of Carnage. By Yasmina Reza, being put on by the Celebration Company at the Station Theater. It opens on the 6th of October, which is just a couple days from now, and runs through the 22nd, as usual. There's many different performances. They all start at 8 o'clock, and you're usually dark, what, Monday, Tuesday?
Mm-hmm. Yes, uh-huh.
And other than that, get your tickets early, because inevitably what happens is a play at the station that is particularly well received sells out at the end because word of mouth gets around. And then people like me, who tend to wait a long time to get their tickets, are lucky to even get to see the show. So start in and be part of the word of mouth. So Rick, when you're directing a cast of so few people, how much direction is typically required, particularly if you've chosen your actors well? And I don't mean this to be a smart alecky question, but I often have wondered that if you have just a few people.
Well, we had to open auditions, and the only member of this cast I've worked with previously is David. So the other three we have not worked together before. They're have certainly done theater in this community, and I think Rachel has also done theater in Chicago, so they were selected through an open audition process. And I really enjoy rehearsals because we start at the beginning by reading the script and doing some talking about the characters and possible directions and development of the characters. And again, it's a collaboration because the actors are certainly welcome to have an input as well as a director. And it's a process where we come jointly together and watch, the show really start to grow and have a life of its own, and they identify with the characters. And so we've been rehearsing, I think, a little over 4 weeks or so. But again, it's the first time I've worked with three of the actors. David and I have done two or three shows together before.
And yet you picked him again.
I did. He's a staple of our company, and a very talented man who can not only act, but as many members of the community know, he has a very fine voice. He's a wonderful singer, too.
Let's do one of the scenes, the next scene that you have, and then some questions for the actors.
So what does Benjamin have to say about it? How does he view the situation?
He's not saying much. I think he's still slightly in shock.
He understands that he's disfigured his playmate?
No, he does not understand he's disfigured his playmate.
Why are you saying that? Benjamin understands very well.
He understands he's behaved like a thug. He does not understand he's disfigured his playmate.
You don't care for the word, but the word is, unfortunately, accurate.
My son has not disfigured your son.
Your son has disfigured my son. Come back at 5 and have a look at his mouth and teeth.
Temporarily disfigured.
The swelling on his lip will go down, and as for his teeth, take him to the best dentist. I'm prepared to chip in.
That's what the insurance is for. What we'd like is for the boys to make up so that this sort of thing never happens again.
Let's arrange a meeting.
Yes, that's the answer.
Should we be there?
They don't need to be coached. Let them do it man to man.
Man to man? Alan, don't be ridiculous. Having said that, we don't necessarily have to be there. It would be better if we weren't, wouldn't it?
The question isn't whether we should be there or not. The question is, do they want to talk to one another? Do they want to have a discussion?
Henry wants to.
What about Benjamin?
It's no use asking his opinion.
But it has to come from him.
Benjamin has behaved like a hooligan. We're not interested in what mood he's in.
If Benjamin is forced to meet Henry in a punitive context, I can't see the results would be very positive.
Madam, our son is a savage. To hope for any kind of spontaneous repentance would be fanciful. Right, I'm sorry, I have to get back to the office. You stay, Annette, you'll tell me what you've decided. I'm of no use whichever way you cut it. Women always think you need a man, you need a father, as if they'd be any help at all. Men are dead weight, they're clumsy and maladjusted. You can see the F train from here, that's great.
I'm so embarrassed, but I can't stay either. My husband's never exactly been a stroller dad.
What a pity. It's lovely taking the baby for a walk, and it lasts such a short time. You always enjoyed taking care of the children, didn't you, Michael? You loved pushing the stroller.
Yes, I did.
So what have we decided?
Could you come by the house with Henry about 7:30?
7:30? What do you think, Michael?
Well, honestly,
go on.
I think Benjamin ought to come here.
Yes, I agree.
I don't think it's right for the victim to go traipsing around.
That's right.
Personally, I can't be anywhere at 7:30.
Since you're of no use, we won't be needing you.
All the same, it would be better if his father were here.
So how far in does that happen? Because things have changed since we've last met these people.
It's a roller coaster ride. They change.
That's only about 3 or 4 pages later.
Yeah. Oh, so things have picked up.
Picked up.
And it seemed like the first bit of venom came from. Okay, I'm going to get these characters wrong, but Rachel as Veronica.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of the beginning of the scene. Oh, yeah, the disfigure. Your son disfigured my son. I don't think she necessarily thinks she's being aggressive.
But the tone with which you invested that line suggested a certain amount of aggression.
Or that they need to understand what's actually happened. You know, that this is what happened and that they need to understand it and, you know, we need to work it out from there.
One of the things that I would think helps define good acting or acting at all and good direction is deciding when to take a line like that, which on the page just says what it says, and inflect it the way you inflected it or inflect it some other way. What have you found to be especially challenging about identifying the lines that need to be invested with something other than what they seem to be saying, maybe?
I think what's been challenging is just figuring out exactly what she's wanting from the other characters in the show and how she's going to get it and, you know, how she's getting her point across. And I think there are some lines in here that can be really, really aggressive, or they can be played, you know, differently, more sincere. And she's a mom, and I think that her concerns are very sincere.
Are you a mom?
Yes, I am.
Does that help or hinder you, do you think, in developing
this
character?
It absolutely helps.
In what sense?
I don't think that I could have understood the stakes of this character before I was a mom. I mean, before you experience parenting, you don't, you know, you can only imagine what it's like. When you have your own child, you know, the stakes for that child's well-being are so high.
And Jessa, are you a mom?
I am not.
I don't mean to be prying with these questions, but you know what I'm going.
She's
no,
a dog.
I am not, and that has been something that was very difficult, and I had some discussions with Rachel about what that means and about what she goes through, and I have been a teacher, and I have taught children that I care about very much. So I do know the feeling of when you feel like someone has been wronged, or when a child that you really care about has inflicted or done something to another child that you've never seen that kind of aggression before, what that feels like. But it being my own child is something that I don't have any reach to. But through my fellow actors, that it's been, because I think you all have children.
Yeah.
They have helped me along with that, so I really appreciate that.
I don't know if it's just the stage of the play that we have reached, because as you've said, it might change in 2 seconds to something else altogether, but at least in that particular scene, Rachel's character had, you know, the bit of protective mom venom, you know, you've disfigured my child, and at least so far, you're a little bit more on the sweet side, and, you know, I could imagine that maybe this is your first child, and maybe this is the first time your child has hit anybody,
yes.
So you're a little bit incredulous that, first of all, this could even happen at all, and second, that it could possibly have been anything malicious, and so you're kind of innocent.
Yes. Oh, yes, I would agree with that. And I bring my husband along to help fight the battle for me and stand up, and he is reluctant to be there.
And does the page suggest that that's the nature of your character at this point, or that's
there
what
is
you've decided?
What is leading up to, everything is internalized, and so it's all pretense of what she comes in with, of trying to smooth it down and keep it under control, and let's not get out of control, and we can talk about this until it reaches a point. I don't want to give it away, but it doesn't last very long. That pretense
don't
unravels.
Give too much away, because
right?
I want to see it, and I don't want to, you know, have it messed up. Do we have one other scene?
We do.
Does this require any introduction or indication of passage of time, or did we just launch into this one as well?
This one is about, three quarters of the way through the play?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So many things have happened.
Things have occurred.
For those just tuning in, we're listening to some scenes from the play called God of Carnage, which is the current production at the Celebration Company of the Station Theater in Urbana. It opens on the 6th of October, runs through the 22nd. Rick Orr is the director, and our actors are Jessa Thomas, David Barkley, Rachel Bradley, and Jeremiah Lowry, and they are, I think, have agreed on where they're going to start.
Mm-hmm.
About three-fourths of the way through God of Carnage.
You think too much. Women think too much.
There's an original remark. I bet that's thrown you for a loop.
Think too much. I don't know what that means, and I don't see the point of existence without some kind of moral conception of the world.
See what I have to live with?
Shut up! Will you shut up? I detest this pathetic complicity. You disgust me.
Oh, come on, have a sense of humor.
I don't have a sense of humor, and I have no intention of acquiring one.
What I always say is marriage. The most terrible ordeal God can inflict on you.
Great.
Marriage and children.
There's no need for you to share your views with us, Michael. As a matter of fact, I find it slightly indecent.
That's not going to worry him.
You mean you don't agree?
These observations are beside the point. Alan, say something.
He's entitled to his opinion.
Yes, but he doesn't have to broadcast them.
Well, yes, perhaps.
We don't give a damn about their marriage. We're here to settle a problem to do with our children. We don't give a damn about their marriage.
Yes, but...
But what? What do you mean?
There's a connection.
There's a connection. Of course there's a connection.
There's a connection between Henry having his teeth broken and our marriage.
Obviously.
We don't get it.
Children consume our lives and then destroy them. Children drag us towards disaster. It's unavoidable. When you see those laughing couples casting off into the sea of matrimony, you say to yourself, they have no idea. Poor things, they just have no idea. They're happy. No one tells you anything when you start out. I have an old school buddy who's just about to have a child with his new girlfriend. I said to him, a child at our age? Are you insane? The 10 or 12 good years we have left before cancer or a stroke, and you're going to screw yourself up with some brat?
You don't really believe what you're saying.
He does.
Of course I believe it. Worse even.
Yes.
You're demeaning yourself, Michael.
And yet another twist. Except many twists have happened in between, I'm guessing. Well, I have to tell you, I'm intrigued. and I hope that our listeners are as well. And that's, all, after all, the point of our presenting plays this way on this show. Is, and you can't, it's rather than just talking about a play, I always think it's a better idea to just have some sample scenes. And you all sound like you've invested a lot into each of those characters. So you've got just a couple of rehearsals left.
Three.
First dress. Three nights. Yes.
Well, and that nervous thrill went through them.
You mean I've got to be off book by now? Yeah, you're off book by now, right?
We're off book.
Yeah, okay. Even though they were reading. Maybe. But maybe. But this is radio, so we have the illusions. anything worth, speaking of illusions, anything worth being said about what people see visually? Set. You described earlier certain colors you imagined.
Colors, a rather minimal kind of set in which emphasis is placed upon the actors and the conflicts and switching alliances. And so Rachel Witt has designed a very, smart set for this play that I think is a very challenging, smart play. I might mention also to patrons of the Station Theater, it's been probably 3 or 4 years ago, Kay Holly and I co-directed this author's other play that was rather popular at the time called Art, in which three guys are having a controversy about a piece of art that's simply a white canvas. And so this is a rather up-and-coming noted playwright, and of course, God of Carnage won the Tony Awards in 2009. So we hope people will come out, turn out to see this latest offering.
So she's not only up and coming, she has come. She has arrived. She's here.
With Tony. With Tony.
Yasmina Reza, if I'm saying her name.
Of course.
That is right.
And of course, we have announced our 40th season. You know, if Kay is here to talk about the 40th season, if you want to.
What do you want to know about the 40th season? Anything?
Run it down.
Kay. All right, I will. We're going to open with God of Carnage, of course. That's our October show. And then we're going to do an original play, a new play by Mike Trippetti, called Way Off Broadway. Then in December, we're going to be doing My Antonia, an adaptation of the novel by Willa Cather, directed by Gary Ambler. And in January, Gruesome Playground Injuries, directed by Matthew Green. And then we're going to do Company, the Stephen Sondheim musical. We're going to reprise that. It was done long ago at the station. And then I'm going to direct Becky Shaw in March. And then Rick is going to direct again in April. And we're so pleased he's going to be directing Red by John Logan, which is the play about Mark Rothko and his art. And we have so many wonderful plays this year.
Well, some of them, they have such great titles too. Gruesome Playground Injuries. Why isn't that the name of this title?
Isn't it interesting? Yeah.
There's no connection, I'm guessing.
There's no connection. No, this is a smarter title.
God of Carnage opens on the 6th at the Station Theater in Urbana, and it's their 40th season. Go out and sample it. And I can say from personal experience that the shows are really good, almost uniformly, of the ones I've seen.
Thank you.
Yeah. So best of luck in fulfilling this 40th year.
Thanks for having us.
For more information, you can go to stationtheater.com, and you're listening to Live and Local on FM 90.9. And our broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from the Meredith Foundation, dedicated to supporting the musical arts in performance and presentation. I'm Kevin Kelly. Stay tuned next for a conversation with David Commande, who's music director of the Heartland Festival Orchestra, based in Peoria. They're giving concerts this weekend at Five Points Washington, a program that includes the Second Symphony of Beethoven and a work called Beethoven Lives Upstairs. We just heard some of the opening movement of the Second Symphony of Ludwig van Beethoven in a performance by the Tonhalle Orchestra of Zurich, conducted by David Zinman, here on Live and Local on FM 90.9, and I played that for you because that is one of the pieces that's going to be on the program this weekend on Saturday by the Heartland Festival Orchestra. It's the second concert of their third season. It'll be at Five Points Washington. That is in Washington, Illinois. Starts at 7:30. And the artistic director and conductor of the Heartland Festival Orchestra, the founding conductor for that matter, is David Commande, and he's with me on the phone from Peoria. Thanks, David, for joining us.
It's always a pleasure to chat with you, Kevin.
Yeah, I have to agree with that. It's one of these days we'll actually have to follow through and have lunch or something, but we haven't done it yet. Meanwhile, we get to talk on the phone about these concerts. So this is, as I advertised it, a concert with music by and about Beethoven. Did I describe that fairly?
Well, in fact, all of the music on the program is by Beethoven, but in a way it's about Beethoven as well, because our program combines a dramatic production called Beethoven Lives Upstairs, which features two actors in front of the orchestra, whose script is designed to tell the story of Beethoven, the man, but also connect that story to Beethoven, the composer, and his works. And so we have a selection of some 30 excerpts from across his opus that illuminate, to use the visual term, or audiate, they give us sonic reality and context to the dramatic process or progress.
Is this related to the film of the same name?
It's the same basic idea. The film goes rather powerfully into the visual aspects of Beethoven, the man who's kind of messy and pours water over his head that starts leaking in the the floor below and so forth. But just to give everybody a quick perspective, the two actors represent a young boy named Christoph who is writing to his uncle to complain that his mom has rented the upstairs rooms to this crazy man, this man Beethoven. And in the course of their exchanges, and essentially they are enacting their letters one to the other, one after the other, in their exchange, you get both the perspective of the young boy on the man, which initially, of course, is very, very skeptical and rejects Beethoven, and then comes to know him, and there's a relationship that develops between the boy and Beethoven, and the uncle, who himself is a music student, a violinist, and something of a composer himself, and obviously that's the ideal character to help connect the boy to a different perspective on who that crazy man is.
And how much, how close to reality, as we know it, relative to Beethoven, is this story? Are these things that are described about him?
It's very close. I think there's a little bit of hyperbole that may come in, and in fact, I felt as if the film was a little more over the top than this particular drama and script does. But we do know that Beethoven moved a great deal. We do know that he was irascible and cranky. We do know that he was eccentric in his behavior, and obviously we know that he had gone deaf, and that had an effect on his communications with the world. So this is in fact a very good and I think a truthful representation of at least a theoretical perspective a young boy would have had on this eccentric man, this great man.
This is a you. I know you actually commented on this for the paper over in Peoria, and I read a little bit of the article. But we'll get to you to repeat some of it for our listeners here. This is something you first did, this piece, Beethoven Lived Upstairs, on a children's program. What, a year or two ago?
Well, it was in fact 4 or 5 years ago, and it was presented just to a student audience. And it was, in fact, in close proximity to a regular subscription concert we were doing, which featured Beethoven's work. And the point I made was that at the time, I really regretted that our so-called grown-up, no disrespect intended, that our adult audience for the subscription concert was not going to have the experience, because it's moving. It's really touching, and I don't mean in any sentimental sense. It really gives you a sense. Here was a very special man who gave immensely to humanity and was never comfortable in the process, and you know had his own demons, his own personal challenges, and it's emotional, and it's wonderful, and there's nothing kiddish. There's nothing infantile or just for very young people. It's completely accessible to young people, but adults will find it fascinating.
So for the young and the young at heart, and maybe not even the so young at heart.
Right.
And so what's sort of the scenario here? The narrators speak these letters, and then the orchestra interrupts every once in a while with snippets of music, or how does it work musically?
Yes, well, there's some of the time when actually they will speak while there is music going on, and then there are other excerpts which are completely uninterrupted. I mean, you get little bits from almost all of the symphonies, and just one movement or another, or parts of a movement, and you get also there are some piano music. So we have a piano soloist on the stage, and even an excerpt of solo piano and solo violin and piano, and just a little bit of recitation with music and connection. So it makes use of the illustrative power of Beethoven's music and dramatic power of his music as it supports the progress of the communication between the two. And I can say, in fact, it happens that the two actors who are going to be with us on Saturday and Sunday are the same who came last time, those years ago, and they are brilliant. The boy is enacted by a young woman named Natalie Berg, and Thad Avery is the uncle, and they're fantastic at this.
And they're now experienced at it.
Yeah.
You actually answered one of the questions I was going to have a little bit earlier, but since so much of what the boy presumably would have heard from the apartment below is Beethoven banging on the piano, which he was known to do, partly because he couldn't hear anything, so he had to bang all the harder. So you do have a solo pianist going to do some banging or just some playing?
Well, Karen Collier, who's a wonderful musician, not only as pianist but also violinist and based in Bloomington Normal, will be our solo pianist in this performance. Karen often is playing violin in the Heartland Festival Orchestra, but this is a different hat musical hat she'll be wearing in this one. And our concert master, Sarah Gentry, will play the violin excerpts.
So I assume that there'll be some excerpts from some of the solo piano sonatas then, and also violin and piano sonatas?
Well, there's a little bit from Fiorelisa, there's a little bit from the Spring Sonata for violin and piano. There is the Pathétique Sonata. There are a couple of excerpts of Piano Concerti, Rage Over a Lost Penny, which is kind of fun at that particular moment. And there's one brief woodwind trio that in the course of the performance, and a little bit from the Moonlight Sonata. So these are all pieces that so many people in our modern world know, even if they're unaware of their titles, and they may not even know that it was Beethoven who wrote it.
Well, let's give one of those examples, just because I always love the name of this one, and it got a laugh out of you anyway. The Rage Over a Lost Penny. Do you remember why it's called that? I can't remember.
I don't know the story about it. I really don't.
Well, we're going to give it a listen anyway. And this is a performance by pianist Yevgeny Kissin, music by Beethoven, that has been nicknamed Rage Over a Lost Penny. And we're talking with David Commande, conductor of the Heartland Festival Orchestra, who will be playing on, I know the concert on Saturday is at 7:30 at Five Points, Washington. When's the Sunday concert?
The Sunday concert is at 2 p.m., and it also is at Five Points, Washington. The Sunday concert will have an extra surprise on it, just as all of our concerts do. However, on the Sunday concert, we will not be adding the Second Symphony of Beethoven. As a result, that performance is roughly, it's a little over an hour total, as opposed to a full-length symphonic concert, and that's part of the concept. So our normal ticket prices on Saturday evenings are $28 adults and $8 for students and young people, but on Sunday every ticket is $10 for anybody.
Okay, more on that in a little bit. Here's Little Beethoven on the piano here on Live and Local. We heard a piece by Beethoven nicknamed Rage Over a Lost Penny, played by Yevgeny Kissin here on Live and Local. That's one of the pieces that will be excerpted in the program by the Heartland Festival Orchestra Saturday and Sunday with Karen Collier as the pianist. Will she also play violin in the orchestra for this program, or she'll solely be at the piano?
We're going to let her be a one role performer in this concert.
Oh, but it would be so much fun to have her running back and forth, or even playing violin from the piano bench. That would be good.
In fact, Karen has done that for other performances. I remember last December playing for the Nutcracker Ballet, and Karen would be playing violin and then go to the keyboard for the Celeste excerpts in that wonderful ballet.
And I hope she got doubling fees for doing that.
Oh, indeed. And by the way, it just occurred to me, maybe it's reassuring to our listeners to know that for us to acknowledge that we conductors do not always know absolutely everything about everything, as in the story of the rage over the lost penny.
People do, amazingly, people sometimes do get that conception. Of course, they have lots of other conceptions about conductors that are emphatically true. And many others that are emphatically not. But that would be a whole other conversation, David, which maybe we ought to have sometime.
I think it would be fun.
Get a round table on the air of conductors and dispel some of the myths and prove some of the other ones.
Right.
So I want to come back to what you said about the Sunday performance. So there will be a musical surprise of some kind, which, of course, you can't say.
Mm-hmm.
But there won't be the Beethoven Second, so it'll be enough to fill out a program. So is that one aimed a little bit more directly at younger people?
Yeah, the concept for Sunday is that it's very family friendly, and you know, some folks are apprehensive about the patience of young people in a concert and how long it will go. And this is kind of a nod to that. I think if there's enough interesting going on that young people often surprise their parents in terms of how long you can keep them. But in any case, this is really designed. The basic idea is that a kid's concert runs about an hour and a quarter, and you don't have an intermission in there. And so that's our format for Sunday.
Well, if you keep kids entertained, they'll sit pretty still.
Yeah, one notices that in a movie theater.
Yeah. Why did you choose, of all the 9 symphonies of Beethoven that you could have accompanied Beethoven Lives Upstairs with, why did you choose the second?
Well, it's perfect timing in a way, because we did the first symphony last season, and we're doing the second symphony this season, and you can guess what we'll do next season.
Does that imply you're planning to stick around for at least 9 seasons?
Oh, yes. Then we'll see about other cycles after that. But in fact, as in all things serendipitous, the second symphony is perfect for this in a way, because since the program is about Beethoven, having the second symphony as this element in the program is ideal in a way, because the second symphony was being written in 1802, which is the time of a real central crisis in Beethoven's life surrounding his finally acknowledging and coming to grips with the reality of his hearing loss, and in a way losing hope that it would be repaired, that hearing loss. He had a crisis in 1802, as many people know, that was expressed privately in this document called the Heiligenstadt Testament, his letter to his two brothers, which combines the features of a last will and testament and comes close to sounding like a suicide note, although it rejects the idea of suicide. But there's a great deal of pathos in this letter, and in some ways, this was discovered after Beethoven's death, so he kept it private. However, for us, in posterity, it offers us a sincere and true glimpse into the inner life of Beethoven at this time. So here he is. He's 32 years old. He lived to be 57. It's roughly the midpoint in his chronological life, and it's a very significant moment in his musical life. The decade running up to this essentially is when he really took on the most important musical forms in terms of what he left behind for us, the string quartet and the symphonies. No offense to the piano sonatas and the other works. However, these were really at the center of the most amazing things Beethoven changed in the musical world in the realm of the string quartet and the symphony. And here he is. He's writing his second symphony, and he's on the verge with the third and beyond of being extraordinarily revolutionary in the changes he makes to the symphony. And many people think of the second symphony as, a very easy listening, simple kind of symphony which doesn't yet show what and who he is. And I'm of the opinion that both the First and the Second Symphony reveal his revolutionary powers as a composer, and they predict or give an inkling of what's in evolution. And to me, the Second Symphony, it might have been called a surprise symphony. There are extraordinary things in it that I love about it. So this whole program, in a way, pivots on the time of the Second Symphony and the Heiligenstadt Testament, especially since Beethoven lives upstairs, gets so profoundly into who he was as a man and how that hearing loss affected his behavior as a human being, among others.
The Beethoven Second is the one symphony of his where if I hear it on the radio and I haven't chosen to play it myself, I almost inevitably have to take quite a while before I remember, what is that piece? That's mm-hmm. really cool. Mm-hmm. And it just never occurs to me that, I don't know why, I just sort of overlook that one, and yet I think it's as wonderful as you think it is. In fact, I just conducted it last year.
Well, and there are amazing things about it. I mean, to me, for example, we both know the opening movement is brilliant. It has this extended introduction, but it's so masterfully crafted with the assurance of a composer who might have written far more than just one beforehand, meaning the First Symphony. And then this long, long, slow movement of such insight and fancy and imagination and variations on this gorgeous slow themes, and it's of a form and of a length which, you know, people are used to Schubert movements being long, but this is really beginning to get a sense of, well, here's a man who one day will write the variations of slow movement of the Ninth Symphony. It's really remarkable. And then you get the total commitment to the scherzo feeling, you know, in the scherzo movement, rather than pretending that it's kind of a fast minuet. And then you get this, for its time, I mean, people went and reacted to the last movement and considered it was a very strange beast that just couldn't be beaten to stop thrashing. I mean, at the time, they thought of it as quite revolutionary. To our modern ears, it's far too easy to just say, oh, yeah, that just trips lightly over the eardrums. But it's quite violent and surprising in its reiteration of what otherwise might be just considered a rondo. But it has that typical Beethoven surprise and drama.
And it doesn't trip very lightly over the violin strings either.
For sure.
It flies by, both for the listener and for the performer. Mm-hmm. Well, it is a delightful piece, and it's a great way to anchor that equally delightfully sounding program, which I obviously haven't seen, Beethoven Lives Upstairs, along with the Second Symphony. It's the Heartland Festival Orchestra concert on Saturday night, excuse me, at 7:30 at Five Points in Washington, Illinois, and then Beethoven Lives Upstairs repeated on Sunday at 2:00 with a musical surprise attached. And David Commande, my guest, and also the conductor of the Heartland Festival Orchestra. And David, I know you guys always have a community partner involved in these programs. You want to mention that before we let you go?
Yes, thank you. Our community partner is Kids Connected. Kids Connected, to have a sense and go look them up. And Kids Connected has been in existence for a few years here, and it was founded with the idea of creating a support system and resources for young people whose families are facing challenges of really significant illnesses such as cancer. So this is an organization which has created help and support and resources for kids who have this challenge that, for example, a parent or a grandparent is going through.
And for more information on the community partners and on the Heartland Festival Orchestra in general, including the rest of their season, and pre-concert dinners that are available for this, and bus rides that you can avail yourself of if you need a ride to the concert, you can go to heartlandfestivalorchestra.com.
.org.
Okay, I never remember that. David, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, and best of luck with the concert.
Thank you so much, Kevin.
It's Live and Local on FM 90.9. And let's go out with some of that wonderful second movement of the Second Symphony of Beethoven. You're listening to 90.9 WYLL FM and HD Urbana with translators W266 AF Urbana and W293 AF Danville, NPR and Classical Music for Central Illinois. We have support from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the series collected to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held on Saturdays from 3 to 6:30 p.m. in the Bouvon Wine Bar. More information is available at thecorkscrew.com.